My name is John Bosnich, and as you've asked me to describe within the Canadian context, because I'm Canadian born and Canadian raised, I would tell you a little bit about my life here in Canada before I moved away from Canada. I'm now in Canada again for the first time in years, but I grew up in Eastern Canada. If you have any familiarity with Canada, we have different political views across the country. Basically, Quebec is sovereignist and wants their own culture and society. Ontario is a business-oriented society with a high level of multiculturalism, which is enforced English-only, unilingual. Alberta is a mercantilist society based on the sale of petroleum products. British Columbia retains some, it used to retain some English cultural aspects, which have since been drowned out by the creation on Vancouver of a new city called Hongcouver, which is the destination of all of the refugees from Hong Kong when it went back to Chinese mainland control. And I come from Atlantic Canada, which is the most conservative, most racist, most traditionalist, closed-minded area of Canada, because it was formed by the loyalists who were so loyal to Her Majesty the Queen, or at that time His Majesty King George III, that they left America when America had a democratic revolution, and they came to Canada. And the closest place they could come to was the Atlantic provinces, where they came to a province called New Scotland, Nova Scotia. Well, being good English racists, they refused to live under the name Scotland, because at that time, the first English dictionary was just coming out, and Webster said that the definition, he had the definition of oats in the first English dictionary, and if you're not aware of that definition, here it is. Oats, a grain et by men in Scotland, but only by farm animals in England. That was the definition of the grain called oats. Now, you can imagine what a self-respecting Englishman coming from New England, now America, would say when he came to a place called Scotland. So to change the province's name, New Brunswick was introduced as the province because the Germanic king of England, pure German, didn't speak a word of English, the Germanic king of England had to be convinced to create a new province for the loyalists. So the western edge of Nova Scotia was converted to New Brunswick. How did they do that? Well, very easily. They named the province for the House of Brunswick, Braunschweig, the German name of the royal family of England, and they named the capital city where I was born and grew up, Fredericton, for the homosexual lover of King George III, his own brother, Frederick. So that's how we got a province, and you can imagine what kind of a place it was. The very first thing they did was convene a provincial assembly. And at the first provincial assembly, because the local residents, the loyalists, had been cheated by the King of England out of their land grants, which were promised to them, and he only gave it to certain favored elite members of the loyalists convened a parliament, the first legislature of New Brunswick, and tried to enforce the land grants. And for the first and only time in the entire history of the entire British Empire, the local authorities allowed the billeted English soldiers to vote. Okay, that didn't happen in India, that didn't happen in Pakistan, that didn't happen in Africa, that didn't happen in South America, that did not happen anywhere in the entire British Empire except in Fredericton, New Brunswick, my place of birth, where they allowed the billeted English soldiers to outvote the local citizens to impose an aristocracy here of white Anglo-Saxon WASPs, who then proceeded to pay the Indians, so-called Indians, the Aboriginal people of the region, one silver dollar for the scalp of all of the French who had lived here previously when this city was named St. Anne's, and the French had been the inhabitants of what was a previous French colony called Acadie, Acadia. Acadia was taken over by England first as I said, it was renamed Nova Scotia. Then Nova Scotia was split into a western half, this province of New Brunswick, and this province of New Brunswick enacted the most effective ethnic cleansing in history up until that time by expelling all of the Acadians down to the remaining French colony of Louisiana, where they came to New Orleans and they brought their food from this region, and that food was called Acadien, Acadian. And so the English, they were assimilated down in America. Very few French Americans speak French today, and their language was assimilated into English. And the food that you eat in Louisiana, if you go there in New Orleans at the Fête Mardi Gras and you have some food there, they're going to tell you it's Cajun food. It's not Cajun food, bro. It's Acadien or Acadian food. That's the history of ethnic cleansing, and I proudly come from the capital of ethnic cleansing in North America.
Hey, are you an ethnic cleanser yourself?
Oh, well, they say we are. They say all Serbs are ethnic cleansers. And the president of Croatia, the late Franjo Tuđman, said that ethnic cleansing is absolutely necessary for the creation of a state. And he wrote a book on the subject called The Historical Wastelands, which the U.S. State Department later withdrew and rewrote to take out his admission from the original version, in which he said ethnic cleansing is the essential element in forming a nation state.
Yeah, well, it seems like that those ideas were very much a large part of the undercurrent in Canadian history that very few of us know about, were taught about, certainly not taught about. But look, you know, it's interesting going into some of this history because we have a very close connection here in Bristol through John Cabot and this organisation called the Society of Merchant Venturers, which just by coincidence, last night I was driving past their hall up in Clifton on the promenade, and around about 7:30 in the evening, all lights were blazing, yet you couldn't actually see in because the whole place is shuttered. Now, the merchants here in Bristol financed John Cabot's trip in 1497 to the exact part of the world you've been talking about there, including, well, Nova Scotia, but also Newfoundland. And the interesting thing about this little group in Bristol is not only were the families the funders of the Cabot trip, but then also they were constituted under a royal charter to exploit the newfound land, a new land, and what you might say the new world. And of course, we had all this history of Europe discovering these people there in conveniently on this land, both with Columbus down in coming across the Caribbean and to South America, and Cabot in North America, and North America obviously becoming far more powerful historically and where the forces went. Anyway, so I just wonder, do you feel this sort of connection with Cabot and his legacy? Because, we really now, the sort of progressives here in Bristol, see him as doing a reconnaissance for one of the greatest genocides or biggest genocides in history.
Well, on my father's side, I'm Serbian. My father was a royal officer in the Serbian army that was defeated when England gave its support to the communist Tito, who was a secret English agent from the 1920s. So on my father's side, I have no connection to New Brunswick whatsoever. However, on my mother's side, and by the way, the Cabot Trail is a walking trail in a long range walking trail in this region, which is very near to my home. But my mother's family is half Lusatian Serb. These are Serbs who are in eastern Germany on my grandmother, my maternal grandmother's side. But on my paternal grandfather's side, they were all Anglican and before that Wesleyan missionaries. So my grandfather, who was an inventor on my mother's side, my paternal grandfather, was the first man in his family not to be a Wesleyan priest in hundreds of years. In fact, my great, 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 seven levels back, great, great uncle was the secretary to John Wesley. And if you know about the Wesleyan faith, the Wesleyan version of Anglicanism, Wesley gave all of his sermons extemporaneously. He had no written notes whatsoever. he was inspired by God, and he spoke directly ad lib in every sermon. The only reason we have any Wesleyan sermons that which formed the Methodist faith, the Methodist Church, is following Wesleyan theory, is because my great-great-great ancestor, Jonathan Dibbs, was the secretary of Wesley and wrote them all down in shorthand that he invented himself. So that's my connection to this system. And so on my mother's side, our family came to North America very early compared to most of the people here in the 1830s. They arrived in North America in the form of a Wesleyan minister who went to Newfoundland, where Cabot had previously arrived, to try to Christianize the heathens, who were the drunken sailors of Europe who were fishing cod off of Newfoundland. So the story we have about him is that he put a barrel of fish on the dock, and he tried to preach to the sailors who were all drunk, and they threw him off the dock 15 times into the water, and he climbed back out and got back up on that barrel and continued to preach his sermon until one of the lead sailors yelled out, "Let the damn man speak!" And thus he founded the first Wesleyan church in St. John's, Newfoundland, the capital of the Canadian province of Newfoundland today. So I do get my speaking abilities honestly.
Well, yeah, and also the connection with Wesley, between Wesley and Bristol is rather big too. I mean, when he came to Bristol, he came across a city where it was almost like the South American natives who were ready for revolt. The Bristol industrial workers and commercial workers were all ready for revolt. There was already a bit of social uproar going on, and he sort of set fire to that in the 1730s. So, yeah, it's very close connections between Wesley and Cabot and your hometown area around there.
Yeah. I'll just jump really quickly through the rest of my childhood up until age 26 here in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, Atlantic, Eastern Canada, Maritime provinces. So I was the child of two educators. My mother was a school teacher and my father was a professor of history and political science. He had graduated top of his class in Belgrade Law School. He fought in the Royal Army against the Nazis, against the Ustasha Croats, against the Albanian fascists, against the Italian fascists, against the Muslim SS, against the Croat SS and the Croat Domobrani, and against the Romanian fascists, against the Hungarian. He fought everybody, and he was the one survivor of his Royal Yugoslav Battalion of 700 men. He, by quirk of fate, made it to Trieste, was saved by a fellow Bosnich of Catholic faith who was the niece of the fascist dictator of Croatia who met him at a relief center. She saved his life. He then managed to get into British uniform and worked as a night watchman. He then got to the Vatican. At the Vatican, an Italian, half Italian, half Croat friend offered him a job. He said, "Sava, you've already..." My father's name was Sava Bosnich, Professor Sava Bosnich. He said, "Sava, you've already got a British uniform. You can freely pass to and fro anywhere in Italy. So here's what I want you to do. Take this briefcase from the Vatican every day up to Milano and change it for US dollars and come back. You'll be super well paid." Well, he passed the briefcase to my father, and the briefcase was so heavy that my father, who was a jiu-jitsu master, a very strong man, had the briefcase fall straight to the floor. They opened the briefcase, and in it were 1 kilo blocks of NDH, Independent State of Croatia, fascist gold. That gold had been melted down from the teeth of the 700,000 Serbs, Jews, and Gypsies slaughtered by the Croat fascists, including my great uncle, Colonel Jovan Bosnich, for whom I'm named. Jovan means John. His teeth were among those gold ingots that the Vatican was selling on the trading market in Milano in 1946 to get U.S. dollars. So the Vatican, my family, my father is a direct personal witness that the Vatican black marketed stolen gold from the concentration camps and the death camps. In fact, there were no concentration camps in Croatia. Everybody in every death camp was killed. From the death camps to the Vatican, they smuggled their gold. The Vatican then smuggled that gold and sold that gold for US dollars. That's the Vatican for you. Okay. Then my father made it. He escaped from Italy when the English were going to return him to Tito to be machine gunned. And his English camp commander, where he was a camp guard. The English camp commander at 4 a.m. woke him up and said, "Sava, don't take anything with you, just your coat. Don't take any bags. Get up and walk out this camp." It was a displaced persons camp in Trieste. "Walk out the front door of the camp. It will be open for 3 minutes. Do not come back. Never look me up. You should never talk to me again." My father walked out of that camp. There were 4,000 displaced persons in that camp. At 6 a.m., that entire camp, along with another 50,000 displaced persons, were sent back in closed cattle cars across the Italian border by the English to Tito, who simply opened up the cars and machine-gunned everybody with 50-caliber machine guns on tripods. That story is called The Minister and the Massacres, written by Tolstoy. It's a true story. My father then had to escape from Italy because he knew he had no papers. He escaped from Italy to Switzerland, got a scholarship to Canada, went to McGill University, and was at McGill University doing his PhD with who? His roommate and then friend, Zbigniew Brzezinski. Zbigniew Brzezinski took off after a year and said, "I'm going south to America. This place is useless." My father said, "Why?" And Zbigniew took his front, his index finger and his middle finger and his thumb, and he rubbed them together. And he said, "Cash." Zbigniew Brzezinski went to the United States, joined the Democratic Party, became the advisor to President Jimmy Carter, handled the toppling of the Shah to create the Mujahideen and the Islamic fundamentalism to destroy the Soviet Union, because Big Brzezinski was a Polish Catholic fanatic. And he also created the Polish Pope, who he dictated to the synod they had to select as the Pope, hence John Paul II, selected by Zbigniew Brzezinski, security advisor to the President of the United States. So there goes the story about the synod listening to God. Pope John Paul II.
There's quite a good film out last year called, I think it was actually it's called Conclave, isn't it? I don't know if you've seen that. But anyway, look, you just touched on Tito being a British agent. Could you shout that, please?
Okay, so in 1925 and 1926, English intelligence services, who were upset that Yugoslavia had been formed after World War I. Serbia was a small country. But around Serbia, there were massive populations of Serbs who had fled Serbia because it had been a Turkish occupied for 300 and some years. They had fled Serbia to what were then territories in Austria, in Hungary, in what was then Italian territory, what was then Romanian territory, and all around the region. And so when Serbia finally liberated itself from the Turks in 1804, not like Greece that needed English support to liberate itself in 1821, I believe, but the first of all of the Turkish possessions in the Balkans to liberate itself were the Serbs in 1804, under a man called Black George, which translates as Kara George. Black George formed a monarchy, a dynasty called the Karađorđević dynasty, which was deposed by England when it became too close to the Russians. The Karađorđević dynasty intermarried with the Russian Tsar's family, and the English were afraid that Russia, through Yugoslavia, after World War I, Serbia took over Croatia, Bosnia, Macedonia, Slovenia, and all of these territories which formerly belonged to either Turkey or to Austro-Hungary, which had both lost in World War One. So Serbia suddenly increased in size by four times and became a major population, one of the biggest countries in Europe. Of course, England had to destroy that country because that country, via Montenegro and Croatia, had access to a warm water sea, which would mean that if Russia continued to be the Yugoslav ally, Russia, after hundreds of years of being blockaded by England and its ally Sweden and its allies Japan and its ally Pakistan and India from getting to a warm water sea, and its ally Turkey, which had held the Bosporus, finally, Russia was going to have access to a warm water port in Montenegro on the Adriatic Sea. England therefore decided that Yugoslavia had to be destroyed. England did everything it could to destroy Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia was then under attack from two sides, from the left and from the right. The English engaged Tito in 1925. He was an agent, not even from this region, never spoke Serbo-Croatian properly. He was an agent brought in by the English, pretending to the Stalin that he was a Russian agent. So in other words, English intelligence recruited Tito and stuck him as a mole inside the communist movement, but working for England from 1925.
Well, yeah, Tito, but there's another side to all of this, isn't there?
And wait, hang on,
because we're missing out the sort of the role that Yugoslavia played in delaying Barbarossa and Hitler later on.
Absolutely. This what happened here was, I'll jump ahead to that in a moment. Let's talk a little bit more about Tito, and I'll tell you about the other English agent from the right, extreme right. So the English agent from the extreme left was Tito, who they stuck inside the Soviet Stalinist formations. And Stalin didn't trust this guy, Tito. So to check if Tito was really trustworthy, Stalin sent Tito to the Spanish Civil War with only one purpose, not to fight Francisco Franco's Falange fascists, but to execute Trotskyists and anarchists. Anybody who was not a Stalinist, who did not follow the absolute dictates of Stalin, Tito was sent to murder, to execute. Tito did that with flying colors, executing dozens, if not hundreds, of leftists who were not accepting central rule by Stalin. He therefore tricked Stalin into letting him be Stalin's man in the former Kingdom of Yugoslavia. Tito had 3%, 3% support in Serbia. So Tito could not have come to power in Belgrade under any sense of anybody's imagination. But what happened was Tito was put in power when Stalin's armies and tanks rolled across Yugoslavia heading west. They installed Tito because Stalin trusted Tito. Tito then went on a reign of terror, massacring 60,000 Serbs. And that meant anybody who wore a government uniform, a postman, a forester, a meter reader, everybody, a school teacher, a professor, a scientist, anybody who worked for the state was shot. No trial, 60,000 in the first year and tens of thousands thereafter. Then he had proven that he was an executioner of the first water. And it came to Stalin's attention finally in 1947 that Tito was starting to do some things without Stalin's consent. Stalin then attempted to remove Tito, and then in the middle of the night in 1948, there was something called the Comintern. It was an international communist organization. And then Tito realized that he either had to kill off the Stalinists, arrest the Stalinists, or he was going to be deposed. And in one night, he sent his loyalist, Tito's loyalists inside the Yugoslav Communist Party, to every influential person's home in Yugoslavia and said, in the middle of the night, at between 12 midnight and 3 a.m., who are you with, brother, comrade Stalin or comrade Tito? Now, this was a crisis moment for a communist because Comrade Tito and Comrade Stalin were brothers in arms and they could never be split. And these two men represented Marx and Engels. And so you didn't know what to say. If you said Tito, you'd be saved. If you said Stalin, you would either be shot or sent to what was called Goli Otok. Goli means naked. Otok means island. And they sent tens of thousands of people to this naked island where they were given pickaxes to break rocks in the sun while being forcibly re-educated from 1948 for up to 7 years of isolation on an island in the Adriatic with 45 degrees temperatures and no cover. That's how Tito took over in 1948. He then followed what was called a non-aligned approach, which was actually a secret English intelligence operation. The English were very upset about losing their empire after World War II, and the Americans were gobbling it up across the globe. Well, being mercantilists and money-oriented traders, the English couldn't accept this without a fight. So what did they do? They created a so-called non-aligned movement, which was an English secret intelligence operation, and they put their man Tito in that movement to attempt to bring Nasser and Gandhi and the Third World into a non-aligned movement, which would actually be a hand-drawn facsimile of the British Empire, ruled by British agents. So they brought Gandhi to England and they gave him a scholarship to go to Oxford to become a Rhodes Scholar. Oh, let me put this all together. Cecil Rhodes, racist extraordinaire, who created a country named after himself, Rhodesia, because he found diamonds and gold there, had sometime previously, when he was, you know, at the peak of his power, after the Boer War, when England took over South Africa, not because they cared about the local population, but very simply because they wanted the gold and the diamonds, because once a pirate, always a pirate. It's no coincidence that the Jolly Roger is a crossbones that very similarly reflects the Union Jack, because the same boats that flew the Union Jack in daytime pulled up the Jolly Roger at night to ransack and loot Spanish and Portuguese ships around the world. But that's another matter, and English drug dealing of opium to the opium dens of China is another matter, and English seeding of northern India with tea, which caused hundreds of millions of dead because there was not enough food for the Indians, is another matter. But let's get back to what the English did through the Third World. The non-aligned movement then created Nasser, created all of these things that the English had tried to keep out of Soviet hands. The Soviets then bit by bit penetrated this new organization, the non-aligned movement. And then we got to the current phase since the 1960s, when the Americans tried to pick up the non-aligned movement. And the Americans, by force of weapons, by the Vietnam War, by their various wars in Central America, tried to physically take control of the Third World. Naturally, we know they failed. They lost the Vietnam War, they lost in every other way, and then they decided that what they would do is bribe them. So they went around the world bribing the leaders of the Third World to become American satraps, and they picked up a thing called the Fulbright scholarships to train their young, intelligent people to be American agents. Now we're back to Cecil Rhodes. Cecil Rhodes remarked to his friends at Oxford, he said, you know, we've got a problem then. We own the world and we have colonies all around the world, but unfortunately, most of our subjects in these colonies are niggers. That's the word he used. Blacks. And they're obviously going to realize someday that we white men are their oppressors and that we're running their societies. And we've got to fix this problem because it's not good optics, as they say today. So what he did is he took some portion of the loot that he had looted from the people of Africa, and he created the Rhodes Scholarship, which, of course, he named for himself, like the country he named for himself, a slave country that he named for himself. Rhodes then used the Rhodes Scholarship to recruit the brightest and the youngest new brains in the entire British Commonwealth and bring them to England and turn them into good racist Englishmen like the empire needed. And that worked fine. We would all compete here in the colonies for a Rhodes Scholarship, and the best student in the whole province would get a Rhodes Scholarship, go off and be trained. Well, the system broke down when one man named Gandhi won the Rhodes Scholarship, and he went to England, and he learned the English system so well that he used the English system and passive resistance in India to take the crown jewel out of the British Empire. And that is the end of the Rhodes Scholarship system, which was then replaced by the American copy called the Fulbright Scholarship. And to link this to Serbia and my own family, where do you think Cecil Rhodes got the idea of the Rhodes Scholarship from? You guessed it, the Turkish Ottoman Empire, where they used to come to the villages of the tribes that they conquered, like the Serbs, like the Greeks, like the, all of the nations that were conquered by the Turkish Empire, by the Ottoman Empire. And the Turkish soldiers would come to the village and say, who's the headman? Because in tribal society, there's a headman, a chief. And they would say, who's the headman here? And they would take the headman and say, who is your oldest son? And they would take the headman's oldest son, kidnap him as a young man, a child, take him to Istanbul, which is just Constantinople, shortened. It's not a different name. Istanbul is a shortened version of the name Constantinople, and turn him into a jihadi Muslim fanatic. Then teach him to be an expert soldier, like a knight, and give him the name of Janissary, or in Serbian, Janičar. And these Janissaries were then sent back to their home villages, where they showed a mark that had been cut on their hand when they were taken away to prove who they were, and said, this is your new chief, the son of the chief of your village. And the old tradition of the tribe was that no matter who it is, the eldest son of the chief shall be the chief. And thus, the Ottoman Empire took control of all of the centers of power, all of the built-up villages, and installed a Muslim fanatical jihadi military governor in every area of their empire. And that's why, just to give you some background that people might understand if they remember the Bosnian War, that's why all the cities were controlled by the Muslims. And why all of the countryside, 67% of the territory of Bosnia, was controlled and inhabited by the Serbs. Because the Muslims set up fortified centers where they ruled by force of arms over their fellow Serbs. Because Bosnian Muslims are Serbs who were converted by the sword to Islam. They're nothing different from us. We're identical. My family is Bosnich. We were princes of Bosnia. We were all Serbs. Then our country was cut up into different territories, and the Ottomans took control of the cities, and some Bosniches from our family, not the oldest line, that's the line I'm in, but one of the younger lines converted to Islam. So you can go to Bosnia today, and you will find a man named Bilal, Muslim name, Bilal Bosnich, who was the head of ISIS in Bosnia. He's my cousin, converted by force to Islam 400 years ago. And if you go to Croatia, you will find a man named Mark Bosnich, who was the champion goalman of Manchester United. And he is a Catholic, because when Bosnia was cut up, the western part was taken over by Venice. And of course, if you wanted to believe in God, you had to become a Catholic. So his family of Bosniches, who were all pure Serbs like the original, were converted to Catholic. And you might remember the scene of Mark Bosnich, a hardline Catholic Croat, giving a fascist Adolf Hitler Sieg Heil salute to the fans on the Manchester United pitch in Manchester, and getting a major fine from FIFA for doing that. That's my family.
Well, look, before we go back to Canada, it'd be nice to get your take on modern Serbia, because it seems to be almost like a kind of tiny enclave of Orthodox pro-Russia within this kind of surrounded by this now NATO-ized former Yugoslavia. I mean, they're kind of isolated. There was also, of course, there was an assassination attempt on the boss. But anyway, what do you make of modern Serbia?
Okay, well, so modern Serbia is on a long and winding road back to its own independence. I'm confident that the Serbian people, who have a history that goes back thousands of years, a history of independence and rebellion against all foreign invaders, I'm confident Serbia is on the road to returning to its independence. That, of course, will require the departure of the current president, Vucic, who is a bootlicker of the West and of the East.
I don't think what you're saying is possible. It's not possible for a relatively small state like Serbia to retain their. I mean, the West is particularly leaning on. On anyone that you cannot in this region be independent. How can you carry on being independent in the middle of a massive superpower battle?
Okay, so first of all, we're extremely stubborn. I mean, you don't know the meaning of stubborn. We're called tvrdoglav. That means hard-headed in Serbian, or rock-headed, especially Bosnians. We are the most rock-headed of all of the Serbs because we fought the occupation by the Ottomans for 400 years without any interruption. I'll give you my own case, Tony. I'm born here in Canada. At age 13, my father congratulated me on my 13th birthday by giving me, with one hand outstretched, a rifle in my hand. He said, "You are now a man." And that came with the delivery of a rifle in my hand at age 13. Why? Because I'm the first man in my family not to be a high-ranking military officer since the year 1279. 1279. Previous to that, we were noblemen and princes in Bosnia, which we took our name from. We came from Montenegro. We were Serbs in the Black Mountains, because you could hide in the Black Mountains and the Turks couldn't get to you. The Black Mountains became named Montenegro, Black Mountains. And we were sent by our tribe, the Rejevici tribe, to conquer the Bosna River, where there were not many people living. We went up there, we built a castle, and we conquered the Bosna. And then we changed our name somewhere around the year 980. We changed our name from Rejevici to Bosnić, which we've been carrying as our name ever since. So that's my family history, which surprisingly enough links all of the histories of the Croats, the Muslims, the Serbs, all of which we all know share the same DNA and were once all one people, but were divided and conquered by foreign invaders who converted some of us to Islam and some of us to Catholicism. So this is a background picture of how I personally found myself over there trying to figure out who was who and what was what. Anyway, back to Canada. I grew up here in Canada. My parents purposely did not teach me Serbo-Croatian because my mother's condition of marrying my father was, if we have a son, you must not teach him Serbian, because my father survived 13 assassination attempts by Tito as one of the leading anti-communist academics and activists in exile from the former Yugoslavia. So my mother didn't want to have a son and have him be killed by one of the assassins that had tried to kill my father. So my father gave his word, and I grew up here in Eastern Canada speaking fluent French and English, but never a single word of Serbian. So both of my parents were activists. My father was the only anti-communist elected to the student parliament at the University of Belgrade in 1941, just before Nazi Germany invaded. One anti-communist in a parliament of 250 members. My mother was a union activist from her Methodist family tradition. She was a union activist, and she took me on the picket lines as a teacher. She was a school teacher. At the age of four, I remember picketing with my mother. And my mother was also the first person in the province of Quebec, which was our biggest province until Ontario was fed money from the United States because they spoke English. My mother was the first woman in the history of Quebec to get her own bank account without a male co-signer, because she graduated from high school at age 17 and started teaching school at age 18. She had graduated from a high school which taught student teachers. So she became a school teacher of grade 12 at age 18. When in September she turned 18, she started teaching boys who were themselves 18 years old, and she had to be pretty tough to have a class of 30 boys, and she was a hot woman, age 18, teaching them. So she got her first salary, which I think was $8 for the first month. And she took that $8 to the Bank of Montreal, which was then our biggest bank, and she said, I'd like to open an account. And she was walking with her younger brother, who was then something like 10 or 11. She took him by his hand because she was in charge of him at lunch hour. So she took him to the bank with her. And the bank manager said to her, well, miss, could your father come in? And she goes, and she said, well, my father's ill. He's in hospital. And he said, well, we need a male co-signer. And then the bank manager saw her younger brother, who was 11. And he said, he can sign for you. And my mother then, she didn't take kindly to be treated like a second-class citizen. She opened her wallet. She took out the $8. She put it on the bank counter, and in front of at least 50 people in the bank, she yelled out, my name is Margaret Peggy Jackson. I've just deposited $8 in my bank account in this bank. There is no male cosigner. If I come back here next month and there is not $8 in my bank account in my name, Margaret Peggy Jackson, I'm calling the police. Good day. And she got the first woman's bank account in Quebec, not signed for by a man. Those are the parents I had.
Yeah. Well, okay, let's ship off back to Canada now, because, yep. You have at the moment a political crisis of some sort. I mean, I don't know quite how this has been influenced by the arrival of Trump, but I'd love you to explain what you think the links are and what's the future for Canada at the moment.
Okay, so Canada is going to stay, I mean, if my fellow Canadians have any backbone at all, Canada is going to stay a nominally independent country. Why do I say nominally independent? Well, because the name Canada implies that we're a country. But actually, 87% of our economy is owned by the United States. Our television, we have more than 100 television stations, less than 10 of them are Canadian. Our youth, our cinemas are all from Hollywood. Our music is all from America, a little bit from England, but all from America, basically. Our culture is American. Our fast food is McDonald's, Burger King, and Kentucky Fried Chicken. Our shopping centers are owned by Americans. And our entire society is a pale reflection of the American dream. That's what we are. We are a resource colony of the United States, which has been, sorry to say this, but sucking the hind tit of the American hog. And that's what we are. And that's what my Boy Scout commander said, my Boy Scout master said to us when I was a young man. He was a Canadian military officer, and he didn't like the American seeping, creeping takeover. And he talked to us about this at some length when I was 12 years old. And I've just seen it more and more and more. Our country has a few good things about it. We are bilingual. We are not monolingual English. We are multicultural. Every different culture, if they have 5% of the population in any area of Canada, can have a school in German, in Estonian, in Italian, whatever they want, funded by the public. We have multicultural organizations. We are far less racist than the United States, although, of course, being a white Anglo-Saxon colony, we do suffer from racism. But we are a much more liberal and caring society, and we have 100% health coverage. 100% health coverage means that when my mother needed a quadruple bypass surgery on her heart to stay alive, her total cost was $25 to file the paperwork to have the operation. $25 for quadruple bypass heart surgery. In America, that runs about $250,000. So America is a fishbowl in which people swim around thinking they are in the big universe of America controls the world, eating each other's shit and paying for the highest drug and medical costs in the world, where the doctors prey on the patients, where the drug companies use the doctors as drug pushers to push unproven medicines and vaccines that kill people, rather than teaching them to eat less and not be obese pigs. Why do they make them eat so much? Because they've got to make a profit. And the food that they feed them in McDonald's, in Kentucky Fried Chicken, in all of the fast foods, these are GMO products, genetically modified products, which they destroy the human fiber. And so we have a nation of the highest obesity level in the world. What happened as a result of that obesity? Well, they got a virus which we now find out the Americans paid to develop in labs in China. Americans paid to develop COVID. This is all admitted now. The virus made it to North America and it killed the weak, fat people. What percentage, Tony, of the people who died of COVID were obese? Do you know?
Well, a pretty high. I'm not sure, but
87%. Coincidentally, the same percentage as the percentage of the Canadian economy owned by America. But 87% of the people who died in America due to COVID were grossly obese. Not obese, grossly obese. They have been fed like pigs for the slaughter at the slop trough of GMO foods sold to them at the maximum profit and the minimum investment by the military-industrial complex's agricultural arm. Why do I say military-industrial complex? Because military-industrial is the single biggest profit above all else. We've now heard about USAID being brought down. Tony, I don't know if you know the Serbian link to USAID. Okay.
Well, we call it USAID.
But yes, well, we call it USAID. In America, it's called USAID. So the USAID director for Serbia was a US-trained, I believe she was a Fulbright scholar. In other words, they came to our country and they recruited her and turned her into one of theirs. She's an open lesbian, okay, who has a wife, which is not allowed in Serbia. We don't have same-sex marriages in Serbia. The premier, the prime minister, we have a president who is supposed to be a figurehead. That's Vucic. He's not a figurehead. He uses an extra legal control system, which is the students are rebelling against. That's the marches that you're seeing in our country now. But the government is run by a prime minister appointed by the president. Well, the prime minister appointed herself, because what was she when Anna Brnabich, open lesbian, illegally married to another woman who illegally adopted a child, okay, illegally took on a child, appointed herself as prime minister of Serbia by simply saying, if you don't make me the prime minister, I'm disrupting all of the US aid money that makes your economy go. So Vucic, between a rock and a hard place, appointed Ana Brnabic, open lesbian, as the prime minister of Serbia, a traditional Orthodox country in which same-sex marriages are not legal.
Look, you're dragging us back to Serbia, but I want to drag you back to Trudeau. What is going on?
Trudeau is the same. Trudeau, how did Trudeau become the prime minister of Canada? Well, they don't tell you this, but I'm going to tell you it. So his father was Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who was – he started out as a communist. He was a member of the Communist Party. He traveled to Cuba during Castro's rule and met Castro, and he was deployed by the Communist Party to disrupt Canadian politics. Well, he realized that communism, especially under that name, would never work in Canada, so he joined the he became active in Quebec politics. He then joined the Liberal Party, which saw him as a good candidate. He married his ex-wife, because they divorced. He married a manic depressive heiress of the I've forgotten her family name, I'm sorry. So he married Margaret Trudeau, who came from British Columbia, who was a multimillionaire. He got the financing, and he became in something called Trudeau Mania in 1968. He swept to power in Canada and took control of Canada for the next almost 20 years. During Trudeau's term, we had Canadian peacekeepers. We had a fully socialized medicine. You don't pay anything, you know, just a registration fee, $25 for open heart surgery. And we developed our water power with major water power generation on Niagara, on the St. James Bay, in Newfoundland and elsewhere. And we became energy rich. And in the 1969 or 68, we discovered major, major deposits of oil in Alberta. Trudeau took all of these resources and made Canada rich by extracting these resources, and he was still a socialist. He created something called Petro-Canada, and Petro-Canada was to give Canadians Canadian gasoline at a discount over the world market. So you were going to go to Petro-Canada instead of Shell or Gulf or Exxon, with then Esso, and you would buy your gas at Petro-Canada and get 30% off. Well, that was quickly kiboshed by the banksters, who forced Petro-Canada to be privatized and then destroyed the entire Trudeau system after Trudeau left office. Who did that? Brian Mulroney. How do I know about Brian Mulroney? Well, Brian Mulroney married Mila Pivnitsky. Oh, Pivnitsky, the Pivo. That's the Pivo is the Serbian word for beer. There's a town in northern Serbia called where Pivnitsky's come from. It's a beer making town which used to be part of Austria. Their family is Pivnitsky. Well, how do I know that? Because Mila Mulroney, Mila Pivnitsky, her father was my father's best friend. When Brian Mulroney decided to marry our former prime minister, our late prime minister, decided to marry, he met a beautiful young Serbian girl at the Westmount Elite Tennis Club, which is where her father, the psychiatrist, Mita Dmitrija Pivnitsky, was a member. And Brian saw this beautiful young woman. I think she was 18 and he was 32. And he immediately moved in on her, married her. They had five kids. They had a wonderful marriage together. Well, they needed to have a godfather, because before she could marry Brian, who was a hardcore Irish Catholic, she had to be baptized, because she had been born in the former Yugoslavia before her father escaped and had never been baptized, because you couldn't be baptized under Tito's Yugoslavia, or it was very difficult to be so. So my father was called by her father and said, Sava, can you come and be the godfather? We've got to, in the morning, we've got to baptize Mila, and in the afternoon, we've got to marry her to Brian. So my father flew up to Montreal and became Mila Pivnitsky's baptismal godfather and her wedding godfather. And thus I knew Brian Mulroney personally, because my father was his godfather. In other words, Brian Mulroney and I were god brothers. Okay, to pull this all this Canadian stuff together, I was at the time a very radical student leader demanding direct democracy down here at the University of New Brunswick in Fredericton, New Brunswick. I got elected 3 years and more as the president here, becoming the longest serving, most elected student union leader in the history of North America. During this time, the city realized we were setting up businesses, cooperatives that the students ran and sold goods at cost plus a minor profit. all of the businesses on the campus that had been set up in the campus buildings to milk money from the students who couldn't shop anywhere else, then said that they were going to suspend their donations. Read the word bribes there. They were going to suspend their donations to the university if the university did not remove me. So the university came in with police, with guns drawn, okay, in Fredericton, 50,000 people at that time, a small little conservative Anglo town in eastern Canada. The police come in with guns drawn and physically arrest the student union leadership and throw us out of our building, which we built. They expel us all from university. They seize the student union government and they appoint young conservatives and young liberals to take over the student union government. We then sue them to the Supreme Court, and to counterattack the university, I run for mayor of the capital city of the most conservative province or state in North America, New Brunswick. It was so conservative that the people who came here, the loyalists who came here, could not live in America, which they thought was too liberal. So they came here and they made the most conservative, most racist, most right-wing place in Canada, more right-wing than Huey Long's Louisiana, the fascist dictator of Louisiana. This is my hometown. I ran for mayor of this hometown when I was 22 in 1983. And guess what? All the other candidates withdrew to run one candidate against me, the three-term incumbent mayor, who was the owner of a big business in town that employed hundreds. I took 36% of the vote. And when I took 36% of the vote, then they called in the federal police and the provincial police and the local police, seized the student union assets of every type, accused us of theft, ran us through a demonization program in all the media, accused us of being extremists and radicals, arrested our members and locked us out and banned me from the campus for life, not for 6 months. They used the old English Trespass Act to ban me for life. So I was banned from the campus in 1986. And I couldn't do anything in my hometown. The campus takes up about half of the city. So I left the province. I went to Montreal and I went to the university in Montreal to apply, because I had just graduated in political science here at the university and I had excellent marks. Well, before I did that, the university physically banned me from the campus, so I couldn't attend my exams. So I called all my professors in the final course, in the final semester of my four-year political science degree, which I did in a year and a half, and I called the professors to a restaurant off campus and said, "Gentlemen, I can't write my finals. They've banned me from the campus and they banned me from the student union building. What should I do?" The dean of arts was there and he said, "We're going to meet. Your professors are going to meet privately. Please go out from the restaurant." And I went out on the street and I came back in and I was handed a mark list by my seven professors and they all gave me A+. They took those marks to the registrar. The registrar refused to accept them. So I went to McGill. I had graduated. I had the marks. I had proof that I had graduated. I went to McGill University, which was our best university in Canada, in Montreal. It's an Anglo citadel in the French province of Quebec, like a fortress. I went to McGill. I was accepted into political science there. I went to present my marks, and I went to the registrar, and they said, "Mr. Bostinch, we can't register you." I said, "Why not?" "Well, we've received a telex from the University of New Brunswick president saying that we are not to accept the 7 A+s from your professors. So that means we can't let you be admitted here into this university." I said, "Just a moment, I'll check into that." "Okay." The University of New Brunswick is a kind of adjunct to the right-wing Anglo regime that runs Canada. To step themselves up a little bit, because it is a provincial university with just 10,000 students in a poor province. New Brunswick is now, by the way, the poorest province in Canada after entering Confederation in 1867 as the richest province in Canada. Just put that perspective. We were the richest, now we are the poorest. We have had something called a brain drain as everybody went out west to work in Alberta to pump oil and to go to Ontario to work in the federal government. So we've been the victim of a brain drain since the 1960s when Trudeau turned it into a resource-based selling economy. Okay, that's why we call New Brunswick No Brainswick. That's our local name for our own province. In any event, I went to the registrar and I said, look, give me a minute. I'll come back with a letter of recommendation that's going to change this. And the registrar said, there's no letter of recommendation that's going to change this. I said, see you in about an hour or two. And I went to the biggest tower in Montreal, built by the most important civil engineer in Canada, a Dr. Robert Shaw, the late Dr. Robert Shaw, who built the CN Tower, which many people know of. He built the 67 Montreal Olympics, which gathered the world Expo 67. He was instrumental in building the Olympic Stadium in Montreal in 76. He also built the Rainbow Bridge over the Niagara Falls between America and Canada. This man was the former rector, in other words, president of McGill. And he was also a member of the Board of Governors of my little hometown university, University of New Brunswick, because it was good for our local yokels to rub shoulders with powerful people. And how powerful was Robert Shaw? Well, we don't have a nobility in Canada. It's not allowed. But in the place of nobility, we instituted something called the Order of Canada. And so if you do something significant, find a discovery, save somebody's life, rescue somebody from a fire, win a Nobel Prize, whatever, you become a member of the Order of Canada and you get a decoration from the Governor General. If you do something higher than that, members are unlimited. There could be 100,000 of them in Canada. We're about 30-something million people. We got about 100,000 who could be members of the Order of Canada. Then the next one up are the officers of the Order of Canada. I think there are 1,000 of them. And these guys really have to do something. They have to win a Nobel Prize. They have to do something. They have to win a gold medal at the Olympics. They have, you know, they have to really, really do something great. They become officers of the Order of Canada. And then there are the companions of the Order of Canada. And this is the ruling elite of Canada. Companion number one was Her Majesty the Queen Elizabeth. Companion number two, of the maximum of 99 companions plus the Queen, companion number two was Robert F. Shaw. Okay, so this is the guy that I get up and I leave the registrar of McGill University, and I know where he lives. He lives in the biggest tower of Montreal because he built it. This is a civil engineer. I go to his house, I come, and this is 1986. It reminds me Blade Runner. Do you remember in Blade Runner where the Blade Runner, where the robots, the androids that have been built and who are being hunted by the Blade Runner to be turned off, to be decommissioned, escape and they come to their creator? Well, their creator is a scientist with big glasses and he lives at the top of a tower in a glass dome. Well, Placeville Marie is identical to that scene. So I come to the downstairs and I press a button and I say, I'd like to see Dr. Shaw. And the man comes on the view screen in 1986. This is not, nobody has this. On the view screen comes up the butler. A butler in Canada? Well, yes. The butler named James comes to the screen and he says, I'm sorry, sir, but Dr. Shaw does not see anyone. And I said, James, go to Dr. Shaw and tell him it's John Bosnich, the man who he spent $2,700,000 of taxpayers' money to expel and destroy the student union at UNB, and tell him John wants to save him some money. And James went away and he came back in 2 minutes and he said, come up. So I took a glass elevator to the top of the highest building in Montreal and came into a glass dome where Dr. Robert Shaw was sitting. And he said, I'm very surprised to see you after our Supreme Court battle in New Brunswick and everything else and all of the money that we've wasted in our battles. I said, I didn't waste any money. I took out student loans to pay my lawyer. You spent $2.7 million and you lost it. But anyway, I've come here to visit you to make a request. He goes, you're going to make a request of me? I said, yeah, I may as well go right to the top, literally. You see, Bob, oh no, he talked to me as John. I'd always talked to him as Dr. Shaw until then. But he spoke down to me as the doctor and so on. He said, John, what are you doing here? And I said, well, Bob, and he almost had a heart attack. He was 82. I said, well, if I'm John, then you're Bob, Robert. Or I'm Mr. Bosnich and you're Mr. Shaw or Dr. Shaw. But we're going to have to get some parallelism here because I'm of age of maturity now. So here's what I need. I need a letter of recommendation from you as the former president of McGill University saying that I need to be admitted even though I have no marks, no transcript to submit. He goes, you think I'm going to write a letter like that after fighting you in the Supreme Court for 3 years and blowing millions of dollars to stop your crazy student union? I said, no, I didn't think you'd write it. I wrote it myself. He said, what? I said, yeah, I've already written it, and I recommend you read it and sign it. And then you and I will never have to fight again, Robert, and I will go down to the registrar, and I will go to the university at McGill and resume my life. And he goes, well, let me see that. And the letter went like this. Dear Registrar, as a former principal, that means president, of McGill University, I've had the pleasure and the honor of recommending many students over the years with the message that attending McGill University would be good for this or that particular student. However, in the case of Mr. John Bosnich, I can only say that it would be good for McGill University to admit Mr. Bosnich. You sign that, Bob, and we're done. He signed it. He sent it. I went back to the registrar. He faxed it. I went straight into university, and I started my studies. So I've managed to get into a master's program in political science at McGill with no transcript.
Amazing. Well, well done. But
I just want to finish what happened here.
You said there's no nobility in Canada. There obviously is, isn't there, with the Trudeau family. We're going to have to get to Justin. What is the political future?
I'm coming here.
We don't have that much longer, so we need to get there.
I'm going to go quick now. I went to McGill for 3 months and I witnessed the case of police brutality. I lay down on the road to stop the police car from getting away and beating the man to death. Long story short, I put the first two police in prison in the history of Montreal, 450 years. I had to leave Canada. I went to Japan. In Japan, I became the advisor of the Japanese prime minister. The Japanese sent me to see what was happening in the former Yugoslavia. I became the advisor to Slobodan Milosevic. When he was kidnapped and taken to The Hague, I organized his defense and had to leave North America. So I moved to Serbia permanently. I'm now living in Serbia, and I've just come back to Canada to fix up my house. Who is Justin Trudeau? Here it is. Pierre Elliott Trudeau wanted to start a dynasty. He had a son named Michel. Michel was the politically oriented, very intelligent operator, apparatchik, who was going to take over the Trudeau dynasty. Michel and his brother went skiing on the mountains in the Rockies, smoking marijuana, and Michel fell down a crevasse and died. Crisis now for the Liberal Party. All of North America has become dynasties. Bush 1, Bush 2, and there was going to be Trudeau 1 and Trudeau 2. People are just like sheep. They're just fed a leader. It doesn't matter. All he is an actor, just like Ronald Reagan. He's just an actor. He has speechwriters who work for the banksters who create his character. So the Liberal Party wanted to take power after the conservatives of Brian Mulroney, who I, of course, knew personally. He'd passed away, unfortunately, last year. So the Liberal Party came to Trudeau and they said, well, what's the story with his other son? Trudeau's passed away himself. Pierre Elliott has passed away. And they need to create a dynasty to get power because people will vote for princes and kings rather than democracy. Well, they've got a problem here. First of all, Justin Trudeau is either bisexual or gay. Got to get him married. Marry him up to a woman. He's got to actually produce some children. Now he's straight. Now we have to stop him from what he's doing. What is he doing? He's a drama teacher. Okay, he's a drama queen who's a drama teacher. Well, we gotta whitewash all of that. We gotta whitewash the fact that he participated in parties dressed up in blackface, acting in blackface. We gotta hide all of that, and we're gonna sanitize him. We're gonna use the lying mainstream media, which is controlled by leftist liberals in Canada, the CBC, and we're gonna do Trudeau Mania version 2. Who did this? Who did all of this? Well, after his father died and after his brother died, Trudeau was basically dependent on his mother, Sinclair, Margaret Sinclair, the Sinclair multimillionaires of BC. That was her family name. She couldn't take care of him. She was having rapid cycling manic depressive incidents and disappeared in the forest one day. Nobody could find her. This is the woman who showed up at Studio 54 when she was married to Pierre Elliott Trudeau with no underwear and a miniskirt and got photographed with her pubic hair showing. She also slept with Castro, which is why people think that Justin might be Castro's son. That's okay. No problem. Well, the American deep state needed a globalist leader for Canada. They knew people will fall for the dynasty story any time. So they showed up at Margaret Trudeau's door and said, "We know you're having trouble with manic depression and your medicines aren't working and you disappeared into the forest and people had to hunt for you. Could we help you?" She says, "Anything." And they said, "We'd like to give your son a scholarship and train him and raise him up." And they took control of Justin Trudeau. They created Justin Trudeau and they made him the Prime Minister of Canada. And then using the son of an anti-American, anti-globalist leftist, they turned Justin Trudeau into Taras Bulba. Are you aware of that story? It's a Russian story. It was a very big film in which Yul Brynner played the chieftain of the Cossacks who helped the Russians take Donbass, who helped the Russians kick the Turks out. Well, at the time that the Russians kicked the Turks out of the current Ukraine, Western Ukraine was part of Poland. And the Poland army had a prince there, and he had a beautiful daughter. And Taras Bulba's Cossack son saw this beautiful daughter when he went into the Polish town to scout it out. And he fell instantly in love at first sight and was ready to do anything to marry her. So the Polish prince said, "Wow, this is great. Let's get him a Cossack to lead our cavalry through the Cossack lines to destroy his father's army. We'll tell him we're just stealing some horses, but actually we'll make the whole army follow him and kill all the Cossacks." So he consents, he puts on a Polish uniform, and he leads the Polish cavalry through the Cossack lines to what he thinks is to steal some horses. And then he looks behind him and he sees the entire Polish army attacking. And there's a battle in which the Poles are defeated by the Cossacks. And in the final scene, he comes face to face with his father, the Cossack leader, and he's wearing a Polish helmet. And his father yells at him and says, "Take that becursed helmet off." And he's the only son of the Cossack leader. And the Cossack leader takes his flintlock pistol and shoots his son in the heart. And that's the book that you can buy and read called Taras Bulba. Taras Bulba was the leader and his son he shot in the battlefield. And after the battle, all the bodies are lying there. And the Polish princess comes and finds the body of her betrothed shot by his own father. And that shows the lengths to which Russia, the Cossacks, will go to protect their ancestral capital and their homeland in Kiev. That is the heart of Russia, just like Kosovo is the heart of Serbia. And these two parallel invasions of the heartlands of two ancient Slavic brothers has brought us to the verge of World War III. Because what they did to Yugoslavia The breakup of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia was exactly what they did to the Soviet Union, breaking it up through their agent, their bribed agent, Boris Yeltsin. And Boris Yeltsin was finally stopped by Vladimir Putin, a secret agent, who came to the top and he said, look, you might be betraying Russia, but we're not going to let it happen. You are going to appoint me as your prime minister, and I am going to save Russia. And he did. And that's how it happened. And Boris Yeltsin was pushed to the side. His daughter, who had stolen $300 million, was given a reprieve. And Vladimir Putin came to power and saved Russia from NATO. And this is all connected. There is nothing different between the parachuting of Zelensky, who is... And Jews in Ukraine are 3% of the population. Zelensky is Jewish. But not only is he Jewish by birth, he's an atheist Jew. So he doesn't believe in God at all. But he works perfectly with the banksters in New York. So they used a bankster oligarch named Kolomoisky, who was one of the eight oligarchs that the American banks in New York set up to buy up the privatized former Soviet Union and to put it all in their hands. Kolomoisky wanted to put a president in power in Ukraine. So Kolomoisky picked a likely candidate, an idiot who knew nothing about politics, another actor. Okay? Ronald Reagan, actor. Justin Trudeau, actor. Zelensky, actor. You get an actor and you create a president out of him, because actors know how to act. They know how to follow the script. And the script of the globalist oligarchy has to be read by an attractive candidate who will lie on command. Zelensky was created as the president by Kolomoisky, who had a monopoly, like in the West, like in Canada, a lying mainstream media monopoly. And they created a television show called Mr. President. And what was that show about? Well, it was a show about this lowly school teacher played by Zelensky, who gets so outraged by the corruption, which they are actually the cause of. Kolomoisky and the oligarchs are the corruption. But they create a TV program in which their puppet, the future president of Ukraine, plays an innocent school teacher, because everybody trusts their school teacher, who defends the rights of the Ukrainian people and becomes the president on the TV show. And the TV show, the TV series, is timed to end with him becoming the president. And it's watched by everybody in Ukraine. Everybody who had a TV was watching this TV show.
You just reminded me of the announcement by the Mossad over Christmas 2024, with the various people who are involved in the pager bomb attacks, saying basically the world is our stage. We write the script. We are the producers.
This of course, sort of thing.
Look, we must get to Canada, because we need to hear a little bit about people like Christia Friedland. Who are the people who are likely to now be in charge?
I've got more. You can't. So where do you think all those scripts are written? Do you think that some Ukrainian wrote the Mr. President series for Zelensky? No way, bro. Kolomoisky called his bro over in Hollywood, where the banksters wash their money on celluloid in the movie industry. Bankster paid Jewish. And why do I say Jewish? I have nothing against Jews. I respect and honor the Jews who I know, who are among the most intelligent, most organized, and most fraternally solid with solidarity among any nation I've ever met. I wish the Serbs would be like the Jews. Well, Kolomoisky picks up the phone and calls his Jewish director and scriptwriter in Los Angeles and says, I need a script. I need to create a president here. They create the series. They translate it into Ukrainian. Zelensky acts it, and he's put in power, just like Ronald Reagan, just like Justin Trudeau, just like Zelensky, and all around the world. It's the new thing. Let's put a pretty face in power.
Well, do you remember? I think a lot of us can see through this.
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
a lot of us can see through this. So we got Christy Freeland.
Okay, who's
Anna
granddaughter of a Nazi.
And also, of course, this man that we know here in the UK for being the former boss of the Bank of England, Mark Carney. So which way is it going to go, do you think?
Okay, here it comes. Christy Freeland. Who is Christy Freeland? Well, Christy Freeland is the Nazi princess. What's that? The granddaughter of the main Nazi World War II Nazi Ukrainian publisher in the Nazi-occupied Ukraine. The SS Galicia, the SS unit Galicia, which is the western edge of Ukraine, which used to be Polish. Remember, Taras Bulba fought the Poles. Well, that was seized from Poland by Stalin after World War II. The western part of Ukraine is actually Polish. Lvov, now called Lviv, by the same guys who try and write Kiev and write with two Y's at the end of their name to pretend they're something different. The western edge of Ukraine is not Ukraine. It's pure Poland, and it will be returned to Poland, mark my words. Well, these guys move in Ukraine via this system, and they use the Poles to create the Nazis, because the Poles, you know who Hitler was jealous of right before 1939, September 1939? He was jealous of the fascist dictator of Poland, Piłsudski, who he had emulated. And when that dictator of Poland died, Poland was leaderless, and Hitler massacred them in the Blitzkrieg. So the Poles have a long history of fascism, and that fascism was reflected by Zbigniew Brzeziński, my father's classmate and roommate, and by the appointment of the Polish Pope to create the NATO Nazi attack on Russia, who the Poles hate. Solidarity was set up by the Solidarity Labor Union with Lech Walesa, set up directly by the CIA. The Polish Pope, set up directly by the CIA, dictated to the so-called Holy Synod in the Vatican. All of this is string pulled by the politicians in America, who actually are just actors. They're just actors who are remote controlled by their advisors. Well, who are the advisors? Well, first of all, Chrystia Freeland became the prime minister's number two in Canada. Well, no, she's not the number two, bro. She is the puppeteer, the ventriloquist who was running Justin Trudeau. That was Chrystia Freeland's daily job. Watch Trudeau, tell him what to do. She was deputy prime minister and finance minister. In other words, she had the purse strings. She basically had Justin Trudeau by the balls, if he has any. She ran the government. When it was obvious that Trudeau was going to lose and be removed, she resigned, attacked Trudeau, criticized Trudeau to try and wash her hands like Pontius Pilate of Trudeau, let him go down to defeat so she could inherit the government of Canada as the globalist candidate. And naturally, every good globalist was the descendant of a former Nazi, the globalist fascist movement, which was financed by the banksters, not just non-Jewish banksters. Jewish banksters financed Hitler. So this all brings the closed circle of how a Jewish president can work with Nazis. Easy. Jewish banksters were financing Nazis from World War II and before. They, in fact, financed Mussolini, the first fascist leader. So this is the closed circle, because Jewish banksters' allegiance is not to the Jewish people. Their allegiance is to Mammon. Read the Old Testament and you'll learn all about it. So this is the picture that we've got here. We are just a cog in the globalist wheel. Justin Trudeau was the candidate. He's now fallen. So their new candidates are two new globalists. Here they are. Chrystia Freeland, Nazi princess, and the founder or one of the key members of a group called, and I was invited to join this group, and I almost did in the 1980s. It was called the Federation or the Alliance of Captured Nations, which was a hardcore anti-Soviet organization in Canada and the United States, which people joined to try to liberate their homelands or their ancestral homelands, because I wasn't even born in Serbia. I was born in Canada in exile, to try to liberate those territories from the Soviet Union. naive people like myself thought we were liberating it to bring democracy. But the CIA that set up the Association of Captured Nations actually wanted fascists. They wanted to reimpose fascists like Adolf Hitler, like Zelensky, who is the cover man for fascism. Why did they pick a nominal Jew to lead their movement? Because they thought nobody in the world could ever accuse us of being fascists if the man we put in office is himself a Jew. This is how it's done. This has been an amazing job. And who are the people around this? Well, Anthony Blinken. Oh, what a coincidence. Freeland is the foreign minister of Canada and then later the finance minister of Canada and the deputy prime minister. So the right-hand man, i.e. she's a woman, but the right-hand man of Canada is Freeland. This is a person of Nazi descent from Ukraine. Who is the right-hand man in America? Anthony Blinken. It's not Anthony Blinken. It's Antony Blinken. I wonder what the origin of Antony is. Ah, he's a Jew from Ukraine. So the Ukrainian Jewish lobby, along with the Ukrainian Nazi lobby, the Nazis take the right-hand seat in Canada, and the Jewish lobby from Ukraine puts Blinken in the right-hand seat as Foreign Secretary, Secretary of State of America. And who does Blinken assign to stage the $5 million Maidan coup against the democratically elected president of Ukraine, Yanukovych, who wanted to do a deal with Russia? Well, of course, they send Victoria Nuland. Who is Victoria Nuland? Victoria Nuland is a Jew from Ukraine. So we got Freeland, Nazi from Ukraine. Nuland, Jew from Ukraine. Blinken, Jew from Ukraine. Are these things starting to piece together for you? And who was in the whole planning of this way back in the 1970s, who explained this plot to my father, his roommate? None other than Zbigniew Brzezinski, who is a Pole who wanted to return to Poland the western edge of Ukraine. So this thing has been in the works since the early 1970s, and it is culminating today. Mark Carney, who is this guy? Well, Mark Carney is a globalist bankster who was the Bank of England governor and previously the Bank of Canada governor. And this guy is the guy who works with the Federal Reserve. Well, you might have been hearing a little bit of friction between Donald Trump, and the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve chairman gave an interview a couple of days ago. Of course, the Federal Reserve was created around the time of World War I, when the United States became a world power, because the international bankster cartel was not about to allow a superpower to not have its money under their control. So they forced through the creation of the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve has, I can't remember if it's 9 or 11 members. Nine of the 11 members are Jewish banksters. Two of the 11 members, one is a token black, just like they say on South Park, the television program. He's the token black, and I can't remember who the other is. So you've got a Federal Reserve controlled by private Jewish bankers. And who are those banker families that run the Federal Reserve? Well, guess what? Those are the Jewish bankers who jumped out of Germany when Germany collapsed. They went after the German Empire collapsed, because they were called Hochjuden, high Jews, or court Jews. One of them is Rothschild. Rothschild was created a baron. There's a wine named for him, Baron Rothschild's white wine and red wine. He was one of the Hochjuden. What were the Hochjuden? Well, because of Christianity, we couldn't charge when people were actually Christians. They were Catholics all across Europe. And it said right in the Bible, you couldn't charge interest. But if you can't charge interest, you can't make profit. You can't make money. So all of the princes of Germany needed to have in their employ, in addition to a court jester, to keep them smart, because most of them were inbred and stupid, in addition to a court jester, they had what was called a high Jew, or in German, in the original German, Hochjuden. And these are the people that Hitler was furious about, because by being the bankers to each of the 87 princes of Germany before it was united in one country again, they divided and conquered Germany for hundreds of years. So Hitler hated those Jews who actually have no allegiance to Israel whatsoever. Their allegiance is to Mammon. So this is why Hitler became known as an anti-Semite. He didn't have anything against Jews. In fact, there were many generals in his army who were Jews. There were many Jews who survived. Do you realize that the majority of the Jews in Germany survived? There were 300,000 Jews in Germany before the Holocaust, and there were very few of them killed during the Holocaust. They all got exemptions. Hitler was killing a different kind of Jew. Hitler was killing what he called Khazars, members of the tribe of Turkic people who lived in the old empire of Khazaria, which is located near the Caspian Sea. The Khazars controlled that area and were pushing into Ukraine where the gold and minerals were, and they had a 100-year war with the Russian Tsars, and the Russian Tsars were beating them. So these Turkic people decided, boy, the Russian soldiers will die, and they say there's a god, and they don't fear death. We better get a god. So they sent out emissaries to who? The Orthodox Church, the Catholic Church, and to the Judaic rabbis. And they sent emissaries and said, we need to have a religion. Come and talk to us. Well, the Orthodox came and talked to them, and they said, whoa, we can't join the same religion as the Russians. Then they could use rank on us. Then the Catholics came and they said, well, what about, what do we do? What do you Khazars do? Well, we're traders. We trade along Marco Polo's route. We trade from the Orient to the West, and that's how we make our money. And the Catholics said, well, you can't charge interest. And they said, we can't be with you. And then the Jewish representative showed up. He said, we're traders too, and we charge interest. It's part of our operations. We do this. We are bankers. And the Khazars said, okay, we're converting to Judaism. So the Khazars became the only non-Hebraic, non-Hebrew Jews. And all of these Khazars were driven out after Russia defeated them into the Pale of Settlement. The Pale of Settlement was Poland. And so they drove them into Poland because the Russians didn't want them in Russia perverting politics and local affairs by lending money and being able to charge interest, because Judaism allowed them to charge interest, whereas Christianity did not. So the Russians drove them into Poland, and Hitler, when he invaded Poland, decided that if he didn't massacre these banksters, then they would take over Germany. And this is the cause of the Holocaust, and this is what drove the madman, as he was, Hitler, even madder than he had been before. And to bring this all together, there was a point in the war when Hitler offered all of the Jews of Hungary to England in return for tanks to fight the Soviets, in return for money to fight the Soviets. And the English said no. The anti-Semitic, Jew-hating English, who are actually ruled by Angles, who are a Germanic tribe, were the ones who sent all those Jews to their death, knowing they would be killed. And they are the people who turned away the boats full of Jews and sent them back to Holland, where they had left from their ports, and sent them to be killed. It was the English who sent the Jews to their death at the hands of their fellow Germans, the Germanic Teutonic Nazis. And why do I say English? Because English is the name of the Angle-ish who invaded Great Britain, which was ruled by entirely Celtic people. Those people were the Celtic Britons, the Celtic Welsh, the Celtic Scots, and the Celtic Irish, and a few Picts and a few Norman Vikings who were on the East Coast, where my mother's family came from, Jackson. The Angles invaded England. They didn't speak a word of the Celtic languages. And they landed and they said, this is not Britain. Hier ist Angelland. And it became England, the name of your country today. And they did the same thing to the French. They're not French. Come on. They're Gaelic. Gauls. It was the Roman province of Gaul. Gael. Gaelic. And what happened was the other warlike Germanic tribe invaded them and cut off the heads of everybody and said, you are going to accept our overrule. They created a monarchy of Bourbons who were pure Germans. And the pure Germans were of the Frankish tribe. And they said, hier ist Frankreich. Hence the current name of France. So these are two occupied countries occupied by Germanic murderous tribes who put down the Celtic local populations. And nobody in Canada or in England or in any other grade school in the Western world is taught this history. Nobody.
No, well, you're quite right. So who's your guess out of these people? The liberal people, Chrystia Friedland, Anita, and Mark Carney. I mean, I find it difficult. I mean, I would have found it difficult to believe that Carney could potentially be taking over from Trudeau. But we now have this bizarre situation where political appointee Peter Mandelson here in Britain is being they're saying he's going to be the British ambassador in Washington. I mean, this is bizarre because this is not a political appointee. This should be a civil servant. So, I mean, do you think Carney really might be taking over?
Look, Tony, I know that you know a lot more than it sounds like you know when you ask me this question. This is a bankster takeover of the Western world. The banksters are taking over. Mandelson is a bankster. He is a Jewish bankster. He is going to take over your country. That is their effort. That is their aim. If they fail this time, they will try again. These are not hazard. These are not random events. This is the way the world is being run. And I remember when I started to learn about these things, who did I learn from? Who taught me this? Well, my father was very, very well educated, spoke 8 languages, and taught me everything that you could find in print on these subjects. He refused the 4th generation in a row invitation to become a Freemason. I've also been invited 5 times. All of us have refused this. This is the entry gateway to the bankster society. But what? Who was it that taught me? Well, when I was a student radical at my university, an old man, short, small, with a very big nose, typical Jewish guy, came up to me and he said, are you the student union president, Mr. Bosnich? I said, yes. He said, I'm Morris Spiro, and I need to talk to you. And Morris Spiro was the communist younger brother of the rabbi of Fredericton. And Morris told me everything about the Jewish banksters who he hated. He told me all of this. And when I went to Serbia, after leaving Canada, after being expelled from university, after putting the police in jail, I had to leave the country. When I went to Serbia to basically save my life, I come to Serbia and I'm at a press conference where the only other anti-NATO questioner, all the media in Serbia had already been taken over by Soros, Jewish bankster, who had taken over the media in the country of Serbia right before NATO bombed. I go to a press conference. There's 100 reporters there. They're all anti-Serb. They're all pro-NATO, except for one, a small, obviously Jewish little man named Mateo Bojanovic Halpern, who became my close partner. Why? Because Mateo was another communist Jew who told me the inside story of how the United States Empire operates and how the Jewish bankers operate. And it has nothing to do with being Jewish of religion. They don't believe in their religion. These are people whose identity is adopted Judaism from Khazaria. These are the Khazarian bankster Jews who are not blood Jews, not Hebraic in origin. These are the people who run the Western world, and they do so arm in arm with fellow non-Hebraic Nazis like Chrystia Freeland, like Anthony Blinken. He's a Jew who worked with the Nazis. the NATO Nazis, and this is the paradigm in which we live. And I want to stress this. I am not anti-Semitic. I saved Bobby Fischer, who was arrested in Japan. I was the Prime Minister of Japan's advisor, and I resigned and sued the Prime Minister of Japan, and I sued George Bush Jr., George W., to save Bobby Fischer. And Bobby Fischer was accused of being an anti-Semite. He said, I'm not anti-Semitic. I'm anti-Zionist. I don't believe that there can be an apartheid state in which non-Hebrews pretending to be Hebrews can take over Hebrew territory and create a Zion that is not of Jewish origin at all. And Bobby Fischer said, I was born of two Jewish parents, both of whom were Khazars from Eastern Europe. I do not have a single drop of Hebrew blood in me. That's why I'm against the Zionist project. And then all over the lying mainstream media of the entire world, he was called an anti-Semite. And you know what his answer was? I'm not an anti-Semite. I love Arabs. Because a Semite is an Arab or a Jew. And well, this
mate, I mean, what you've done is you've led us on here to wind up, and I really mean that, but by looking at the Gaza conflict right now, and I mean, one of the most key things it seems to me is there's a lack of understanding between the difference between political Zionism and religious Zionism, because in the synagogues, the Jews have prayed this Amidah prayer for centuries about going back to Jerusalem. The difference is that they are asking God to do it. And it seems now we've got a political Zionist movement which has said, well, God is taking too long. Now we're going to have to do it ourselves. And that, exactly. That actually, Hitler was a big part of this in exterminating so many European Jews who would not go to Israel.
Not only that, we got to go on with this. Hitler signed a pact with the Zionist organization in Germany, signed a contract with them to export all Jews to Israel. The English didn't want to do it because the English wanted to dump the Jews on Hitler and create a crisis inside Germany. You'll remember that the first terrorism in the Middle East was when Jewish terrorists from the Stern Gang, Stern, a German name, and I've forgotten the other group, the future prime ministers, Begin, and I've forgotten the other, the Labour.
The Haganah.
Yes, these were terror organizations, which they didn't kill Arabs, they killed British soldiers. They killed and murdered British soldiers. So the first terror bombings and the first terrorists in the Middle East were these Zionist extremists who were not even Hebrew in origin. These are the Khazars who, to cover their tracks and to take a nation and to make it the Khazar state in the world, have seized a Semite territory inhabited by real Semitic Jews and real Semitic Arabs who lived together in peace for hundreds of years and have created an apartheid state. An apartheid state in which Turkish Khazars, posing as Jews like Zelensky, want to create a world empire focused on Israel because they are the banksters who remote control the actors who they puppeteer in all of the countries around the world that they control. Tony, that's the story.
Well, hang on, because what's going to happen, do you think, with Trump and Gaza now?
Oh, well, Trump wants to turn it over to a Jewish-financed real estate project. And Trump, you know what? Here in Canada, we'd say Trump doesn't give a flying F. He doesn't care. He's set for life. He's financed by Adelson, who runs the casinos in Las Vegas. He has unlimited cash. He's married his daughter off to a leading Zionist activist. He sold his soul to the people who paid for it. And when Trump says he's America first, well, there are a lot of us out here who strongly support Trump. I can tell you about that a paradoxical stand. I strongly support Trump. Why? because Trump is pulling off all the curtains. He's pulling back the curtains. He's letting you see the Wizard of Oz. He's letting you see who runs it all. That's what Trump's value is. He can't keep a secret. Trump is working for the Israel Zionist lobby, and he's admitted it. And it's not America first. It's Zion first.
No, well, this is epic stuff. This is epic stuff, John. But quite clearly, the Chinese and the Russians are superpowers. They're not just going to simply allow this to roll over, are they?
No, they aren't. But watch out, because the Chinese are the Asian version of the Jews. They are industrious. They are very good businessmen. They are amazing traders. And the Jewish capital, once again, it's a play on words and terms. It is not Jewish capital. It is Khazar bankster capital. These people do not believe in God. They are not Jews. To be a Jew, you must believe in God. That is the definition of a Jew.
You seem to be implying here the Chinese and the Americans. I suppose maybe with Wuhan, you might be right, but they're working together. They're both godless.
Not yet. Not yet. But I can tell you that the biggest financial transfer after the Jews of Germany moved to London, the city of London, which they controlled, and then when they moved from London to New York, after the British Empire had the sun set on it, they moved to where the new capital of the world empire was. That's New York, not Washington. Money talks, not some puppet, not some actor in the White House. And now they're in the process, in the biggest capital transfer in the history of the human race, they're in the process of moving to Shanghai. And when the Khazar pseudo-Jewish banksters who do not believe in God and do not believe in Judaism, when they transfer their cash to Shanghai, the capital of the world empire will be in China. And that's how history goes. And that is, you can trace it through history. There is no break in this chain. This is the way this world is run, and I'm looking forward to seeing Musk get us to Mars, because there is a hope that maybe if we get to a new planet, we can do it differently.
But you're saying there is no hope down here, then? That's a bit bleak, isn't it? The Orthodox Church
It's not no hope.
Well, the Orthodox Church wouldn't agree with you. They'd say, the Book of Revelation tells us what's going to happen. There's going to be an almighty fight.
That's correct.
And God will win.
That is correct, and I believe in that. But until that fight happens, we are in this trap. And this is why I'm speaking openly about this. I know I am not anti-Semitic. Not only do I not dislike Arabs, I also do not dislike Jews. It is not the average Hebraic normal Jew who is responsible for any of this. My first girlfriend was a Jew. My father's first girlfriend was a Jew. My financial supporters have always been Jews. My collaborators in school have been Jews. They're better educated. They are multilingual. These are an elite group of human beings. But it is the subset of that elite group of super powerful, super educated individuals that has adopted their name and their religion and their identity, who are not Hebraic, who are not Hebrews, who are Khazars, who are Turks. They are the ones who are trying to pull off this global putsch.
We shall see. I don't think they're going to succeed. The book of Revelation talks about something called the Synagogue of Satan, doesn't it?
Yes. I can tell you, Tony, that, every believing Christian and every believing Jew follows the same book, at least the first part of that book. And it clearly states, and in all other Jewish writings, Judaic religious writings, it clearly states that the kingdom of Israel based at Jerusalem can only, not somewhat, only be restored when the Messiah returns. And let me tell you, Netanyahu is not the Messiah, and Donald Trump is not the Messiah. And if these two are creating the state of Israel with the capital at Jerusalem, they are not acting in the name of the Messiah. They are acting in the name of the Messiah's enemy. They are acting in the name of the imposter. They are acting in the name of Satan. That's what's happening.
Yeah, and the Antichrist, possibly. That's right. Obviously, many Jews
Correct.
Maybe particularly ones that aren't following biblical stuff at all. They are hoping, they're looking at their watches, aren't they? Where is this Messiah of ours? It obviously wasn't Jesus. We're still waiting. And so by imposing a Messiah, that could, of course, become an Antichrist figure.
And then there will be the Armageddon, in which God, the real living God, the God of all Jews, the God of all Arabs, the God of all Muslims, the God of all Hindus, the God of all Christians, the God of all gods, the one God, will crush the Antichrist and crush Satan and bring the kingdom of heaven, that imaginary place, a Garden of Eden in the sky where we think our souls go. He will bring it down to this earth, raise the dead, and we will all live on peace in the one and only inhabited speck of dust in the entire known universe.
Okay, so you're not quite such a fan of Musk and his mission to Mars then, really?
I like Musk's mission because I'm a trained engineer and I won the world prize in geodetic engineering. And I know that there is a not negligible possibility of another asteroid making a crater the size of the last one, the Pacific Ocean, and destroying all living beings on this planet. And I know it's not a trivial possibility. And I know that there are computer projections that asteroid is already on its way. Knowing this, we need a second planet if we want humanity to exist.
That's just about okay, I suppose. Can you just let listeners know whereabouts they can find you and follow you?
Well, you can see me still on Facebook. I'm in the legacy lying mainstream media on Facebook. I'm on X, JohnBosnitch. I think my moniker there might be J Bosnitch, Bosnitch. And I'm very happy to hear from anybody. I'm on Skype, by the way, if you've got legacy lying mainstream media. And so I'm on Skype under my name as one word, JohnBosnitch. Call me on Skype or send me a text. I look forward to collaborating with all people who would like to see the prophecy and the politics and the business and the culture of this planet co-align in a paradise which we can make as we were intended to make.
And you know what I'd say to back that up is, you know, it's quite clear from what you've been saying, from my research over the decades, that there really is only a tiny number, really a fraction of number of people that are behind the hell holes that we're seeing today, places like Gaza. I mean, this is a tiny fraction of the population doing this.
Less than 10,000 people run this world. And I know that, Tony, because, you know, these are all what my grandmother, my Serbian grandmother, who was a multimillionaire, one of the very few multimillionaires in Serbia before World War I, she went to study esoteric sciences in Budapest during the time that her area of the country was in Austro-Hungary. And she was taught to read crystal balls and tarot cards and all by the biggest scientists of Austro-Hungarian Empire. So, Tony, I was born on the National Day of Serbia in Canada in exile during a 100% eclipse of the sun directly over Kosovo. Okay? So my grandmother told me at age 5, John, she spoke to me in English. I didn't speak Serbian. She said, John, you will marry a Serbian girl. You will have Serbian sons. You will return to Serbia and you will aid in the battle to free Serbia. And during your lifetime, Serbia will be free. This is your future.
Wow. Anyway, John Bosnitch, thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure to have somebody with the patience that you have, Tony, because very few people would put up with me. Thank you.
That's okay. It's lovely to speak to you. We'll speak to you again soon sometime.
My pleasure.
Thank you for all your predictions about Canada and insight into what's actually going on.
I strongly support Trump's sanctions. I want my native Canada to be a free country. I want 2,000% sanctions. I want to stop selling our oil and gas for cents on the dollar to America. I want us to be a free, bilingual country with a multicultural society that is not all huddled 100 miles from the U.S. border. Let's bring it on. Trump, kick us out of the nest. Be the mother bird. Kick us out so we fly or die. Let's do it.